On a warm July morning in 2007, the unthinkable unfolded inside a quiet upper-class home in Cheshire, Connecticut. Dr. William Petty was beaten nearly to death in his basement. Upstairs, his wife was being raped and strangled. His two daughters, 17 and 11, were tied to their beds, forced to listen, then burned alive as gasoline turned their home into a furnace. The assailants? Two career criminals on parole who had randomly targeted the Petit family after spotting them at a grocery store. This wasn't a robbery gone wrong. It was evil premeditated. Hours of terror that ended in a house soaked in blood and fire, and a town ripped apart by grief and rage. But the darkest part isn't just the brutality. It's how easily it could have been stopped if someone had simply listened to the signs. Why didn't police intervene sooner? Why were two violent men free after dozens of prior offenses? And how does a man rebuild after watching his entire family burn? So, if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The House on Sorghum Mill Drive. The sun had just begun to rise over the quiet tree-lined neighborhood of Sorghum Mill Drive in Cheshire, Connecticut. It was July 23, 2007, a Monday, the kind of day that starts with birdsong and a promise of warmth, where nothing should go wrong. But inside the two-story colonial house, with its cream-colored siding and tidy shutters, evil was already in motion. Dr. William Petit, a 50-year-old endocrinologist, had dozed off in a sunroom at the rear of the house. He'd gone there the night before, stretched out on a couch with the Sunday paper. His wife, Jennifer Hawke Petit, had taken their daughters, 17-year-old Haley and 11-year-old Michaela, upstairs after a long weekend. That night, no one suspected it would be their last. Two men lurked outside the house, Joshua Komisarjevsky and Stephen Hayes. They had followed Jennifer and Michaela earlier that day from a local Stop and Shop grocery store. Komisarjevsky had noticed the mother and daughter in the parking lot and zeroed in on them. Two soft targets in a wealthy town. He watched them return to their minivan, take the groceries home, and pull into the garage. That was all he needed. That night, as the Petits slept, the two men returned. They cut the phone lines and slipped through an unlocked screen door. Komisarjevsky carried a bat. Hayes carried rage. They found Dr. Petit first, asleep in the sunroom. Without warning, Komisarjevsky smashed the bat into his skull. Blow after blow, he beat the doctor until blood pooled beneath the couch. Then they tied his wrists and ankles and dragged him to the basement. William Petit was unconscious within minutes, or at least he appeared to be. In truth, he slipped in and out of awareness, helpless to stop what came next. Upstairs, Jennifer and the girls were yanked from their beds. Jennifer was tied to a chair in the living room. Haley and Michaela were tied to their beds. Their mouths were gagged with cloth, their hands secured above their heads. The invaders weren't wearing masks. They had no fear of being recognized. That should have been a sign. But it wasn't just a home invasion. As Komisarjevsky later admitted in his chilling diary, it was a hunt. He had a taste for control, for domination. Hayes, older and louder, wanted money and sex. The two were a combustible combination. Both had long criminal records. Both had been released from prison just months earlier. Both had failed rehab programs, and both were somehow still walking free. The terror stretched into the early morning. The men rummaged through the house looking for cash. They forced Jennifer to write a check for $15,000, but banks didn't open until 9 a.m. That meant they had to wait, and that meant the family had to suffer longer. They gave Jennifer an ultimatum: go to the bank, withdraw the money, and come back alone. If she said a word to anyone, her daughters would die. She agreed. At 9 a.m., she entered the Bank of America on Main Street. Security footage shows her looking composed but tense. A teller greeted her. "I need to withdraw $15,000, she said. "It's an emergency. My family is being held hostage." The teller froze. Jennifer kept talking, clearly trying not to raise suspicion. "Please, don't call the police," she added. "They said they'd kill my daughters." But the bank manager didn't listen. As Jennifer walked back to the car, where Hayes waited in the driver's seat, the manager dialed 911. What happened next is where the nightmare deepens. Local police were dispatched immediately. Officers set up a perimeter. They parked just blocks away from the house, but instead of intervening, they chose to wait. Protocol, they said. They wanted to observe, gather intelligence, prepare for a hostage negotiation, but there was no time for strategy. Inside the house, the situation deteriorated rapidly. With the money secured, Hayes and Komisarzewski escalated the violence. Komisarzewski, who had been left alone with Mikhaila, sexually assaulted her. He photographed it. He would later say it was non-penetrative, as if that lessened the horror. He described her as innocent in his diary, then claimed he kissed her forehead afterward. A moment of twisted self-justification. Hayes, meanwhile, raped Jennifer Hawke-Pettit on the living room floor, then strangled her to death with his bare hands. The mother was dead. The daughters, still tied to their beds, were next. William Pettit regained consciousness in the basement. He was woozy, his vision blurred, but he heard something upstairs, screaming, movement, a change in energy. Something was wrong, worse than before. He looked down. His wrists were still tied, but the rope had loosened slightly. Blood dripped from his head. He forced himself to move. He twisted and wriggled until one hand slipped free. Then the other. He crawled up the stairs, through the garage, and out into the backyard. Barefoot, bleeding, and barely alive, he stumbled to his neighbor's house, collapsing on the porch. "Call 911," he gasped. "They're killing my family." At nearly the same moment, Hayes and Komisarzewski realized Dr. Petit was gone. Panic set in. The police would come. They had to erase evidence. Fast. They poured gasoline throughout the house, onto the girls, onto the stairs, onto the carpets and curtains. Then they lit a match. A fireball exploded through the house. Flames shot from the windows. Smoke billowed into the street. The heat was so intense, firefighters couldn't enter. But the girls were still alive, tied to their beds, blindfolded, and screaming. The fire consumed everything in minutes. Hayes and Komisarzewski tried to flee in the Petit's Chrysler Pacifica, but it was too late. Officers rammed the car near the end of the street. Both men were pulled out and arrested. One was covered in blood. The other smelled like gasoline. It was over for them, but not for William Petit. He sat in the back of an ambulance as his house burned to the ground. Paramedics worked on him, but he barely responded. He whispered his wife's name, his daughter's names. He hadn't seen them. He hadn't been able to stop it. And now, he was the only one left. What the police knew and didn't do. As news of the home invasion spread, so did the questions. Why had the police waited? Why didn't they storm the house once they knew a hostage had been taken? Why didn't they act the moment Jennifer walked into the bank? Cheshire police stood by their decisions. They cited protocol, containment strategy, and the need to avoid triggering violence. But in hindsight, the delay cost lives. Hayley and Mikhaila were alive when officers arrived. They were tied up, terrified, and flammable. Some officers admitted later they didn't expect the attackers to set the house on fire. They thought they had more time. They didn't. Investigators recovered Jennifer's body near the front door. Mikhaila was found in her bedroom, burned beyond recognition. Hayley had managed to free one leg and crawl down the hallway before she collapsed. Her body burned, her lungs filled with smoke. She was just weeks away from starting college. The medical examiner confirmed what no one wanted to hear. The girls died from smoke inhalation. They had been alive when the flames began. The killers and their past. Stephen Hayes was 44 years old. Joshua Komisarzewski was 26. Both were lifelong criminals with long rap sheets, burglary, assault, drug charges. Both had been released early from prison, despite numerous red flags. Hayes had failed multiple rehabilitation programs. Komisarzewski had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, post-traumatic stress, and compulsive sexual behavior. He was a self-described master manipulator, someone who enjoyed watching people squirm. Despite this, he was granted parole. Worse, both were part of a halfway house program, the kind meant to help offenders reintegrate. But the system failed. There were no background checks, no psychological reviews, no mandatory GPS monitoring, and no one, not parole officers, not supervisors, not community support staff, had caught what they were planning. It was a catastrophic failure of the criminal justice system. Dr. William Petit, the survivor. In the days after the murders, Dr. William Petit became a symbol of tragedy, of resilience, and of haunting survivors' guilt. His face was plastered across the news, eyes swollen, head bandaged, voice trembling. "I tried to get help," he said. "I thought I could save them." But he hadn't, and that thought would eat at him for years. He moved in with his parents. He stopped practicing medicine. He lost weight, slept little, and lived in silence. Journalists called. Strangers wrote letters. Churches held vigils. But nothing could change what had happened in that house. One night, a reporter asked him what he missed most. He paused. "The little things," he said, "hearing them laugh, seeing them come down the stairs in the morning." Chapter 2. The trials, the verdicts, and the unforgettable tapes. The town of Cheshire didn't sleep for months. Neither did the state of Connecticut, and certainly not William Petit. The aftermath of the invasion wasn't just grief, it was fury. A family had been butchered, tortured, and burned alive in a supposedly safe, upper-middle-class neighborhood. The killers were caught. Their confessions were graphic. But somehow, the process was only just beginning. The justice system moved slowly. First came the autopsies, then the forensic reports, then finally, the charges. 17 counts of capital felony, including kidnapping, sexual assault, arson, and murder. Stephen Hayes would go to trial first. A trial like no other Hayes's trial began in New Haven in September 2010, over 3 years after the murders. By then, he had already confessed in full detail. His only hope was to avoid the death penalty. The courtroom was packed. Reporters from CNN, the New York Times, and every local outlet squeezed into the gallery. But no one mattered more than the man in the front row, William Petit, face hollow, hands clenched, wearing the same wedding band he had the night of the murders. He came every day. He sat through every detail, every photo, every word. The prosecution wasted no time. They showed jurors' crime scene photos, played 911 recordings, and introduced Jennifer's bank surveillance footage. They displayed images of Michaela's blood-stained clothing. They revealed Hayes's own confession, where he said he snapped and strangled Jennifer, while Komisarzewski took care of the kid. Hayes, overweight and shackled, sat silently at the defense table. Occasionally, he cried. Occasionally, he yawned. The defense tried to blame Komisarzewski. They called Hayes a follower, a man manipulated by a younger, more sadistic partner. But the jury didn't buy it. The crime was too vicious. Too prolonged. Too personal. On October 5, 2010, Hayes was found guilty of all counts. 2 weeks later, the jury sentenced him to death. As the sentence was read aloud, Dr. Petit held back tears. He later said, "Today justice was served, but the pain doesn't end." The Komisarzewski trial, the mind of a monster. Joshua Komisarzewski's trial began a year later. It was even more brutal. Komisarzewski didn't deny being there. He admitted to photographing Michaela, admitted to beating Dr. Petit, admitted to helping tie up the girls. But his defense was chilling. "It wasn't my idea to kill them." In court, his attorneys argued he lacked intent, that he never wanted the family to die, that the fire, the real killing blow, had been Hayes's decision. But then came the evidence that shattered any illusion of remorse. In the days after the murders, Komisarzewski had written a 75-page journal in his jail cell. It was part diary, part manifesto, and part confessional. In it, he described Michaela in detail, her appearance, her fear, even the way she smelled. He insisted he didn't rape her, but he admitted to enjoying the closeness. He called Hayes a beast, but never once condemned his own role. Worst of all, he blamed Dr. Petit. He wrote that the father should have done more, that he was weak, that any real man would have protected his family. The courtroom gasped when that line was read aloud. Dr. Petit sat still, but the grief on his face turned to rage. The victim speaks. When it was his turn to speak, William Petit stood before the court with shaking hands and a folded piece of paper. His voice cracked, but he didn't look away. "They tied up my family, They beat me with a baseball bat and left me for dead. They raped my wife and daughter. They set them on fire. He paused. Every minute I breathe, I do so for my wife, for Haley, for Michaela. These men, these monsters, took everything from me, but they won't take my voice. His testimony stunned the courtroom into silence. Even Komisarzewski looked away. On October 13, 2011, the jury returned its verdict. Guilty on all counts, Komisarzewski was sentenced to death. Trial tapes, the haunting audio. The tapes from the trials would later circulate online, played in true crime documentaries and court specials. They weren't just records, they were emotional wreckage. On the tapes, you can hear Jennifer's voice on the bank surveillance footage. Calm, but terrified. You can hear the 911 dispatcher whispering, "Stay on the line." You can hear Dr. Petit sobbing during his impact statement, his voice cracking as he said, "They were my girls." One particularly disturbing recording came from Hayes's confession. In it, he laughs nervously as he tells investigators how he raped Jennifer. "She stopped moving," he says, almost offhandedly. "I guess I strangled her." Another recording, a private one never played for the public, reportedly captured Komisarzewski, describing how he lit Michaela's bed on fire. "It caught fast," he said. "It spread to the curtains and that was it." Lawyers debated whether to make that recording public. Ultimately, it stayed sealed. Too graphic, too damaging. But the trial tapes that did emerge reshaped public understanding. This wasn't a robbery. It was planned torture. A family was held captive, tormented, and destroyed, slowly, over 7 hours, while law enforcement stood outside. Aftermath: life, death, and a repeal. With both men sentenced to death, the town of Cheshire finally exhaled, but in 2015, Connecticut's Supreme Court repealed the death penalty, retroactively. That meant Hayes and Komisarzewski would no longer face execution. They would live out their days in prison. The ruling sent shockwaves through the state. Protesters rallied. Victims' families demanded a reversal. Dr. Petit, once a soft-spoken doctor, became a political force. He publicly slammed the ruling. The death penalty was the only fitting punishment for what they did. "My daughters died in a fire. They were alive when it started. How is that not worth death?" Petit ran for office shortly after. He won a seat in the Connecticut House of Representatives, not out of ambition, but necessity. "I never wanted to be in politics," he said, "but I couldn't stay silent anymore." Today, both Hayes and Komisarzewski are serving life sentences without the possibility of parole. They are housed in separate prisons, under high security. Neither has expressed true remorse. Komisarzewski briefly filed appeals, citing ineffective counsel and psychological trauma. All were denied. Hayes, in a 2016 letter to the Hartford Courant, said he had converted to Christianity. He asked the Petit family for forgiveness. Dr. Petit never responded. A town changed forever. The Petit's house was demolished just months after the crime. Neighbors couldn't bear to look at it. In its place now stands a quiet garden with a small plaque. In memory of Jennifer, Haley, and Michaela. But the town is different now, more cautious, less trusting. An annual charity run in Haley's name brings thousands together every year, but always in a tone of reverence, not celebration. Haley had been accepted to Dartmouth. She wanted to become a doctor like her dad. Michaela loved cooking. She once made a handwritten cookbook for her mother as a gift. Jennifer was a nurse who worked with multiple sclerosis patients. She had founded a fundraiser to help others battling the disease just months before her own life was taken. Their legacy lives on, not through courtrooms, but through kindness. The Petit Family Foundation funds scholarships for young women and research into chronic illness. It also supports survivors of violence, people like William Petit, who walk through life with invisible wounds. Final reflection: how many systems failed? The Cheshire home. Invasion wasn't just a horrific crime, it was a systemic failure. Hayes and Komisarzewski should never have been free. Both had violated parole multiple times, both showed signs of escalation, yet they slipped through every crack. The police response, cautious and passive, left three victims to die preventable deaths. Jennifer did everything she could to protect her daughters. She went to the bank. She begged. She stayed calm, and she was strangled for it. And still, somehow, the burden of justice fell on the only survivor. Dr. Petit didn't just lose his family, he lost his faith in the system. And maybe we should too. Because if two violent criminals can slip out of halfway houses, follow a mother and daughter from a grocery store, and torture a family in a quiet neighborhood, what else is possible? So the next time someone tells you crime doesn't happen in nice towns, remember Cheshire, and ask yourself, would you have survived? Would your family have been saved? Or would you still be waiting for the police to act?